You're listening to FemMonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and I'm on a mission to raise the policy conversation around gender and inclusion. Today, we're talking about something that I've wanted to do an episode on for a really long time, gender equality and climate change. Our public discourse in Canada has been dominated by the economic impacts of climate change, specifically the carbon tax. We also hear about the urgency and what's happening to our lands, waters, and wildlife. We talk very little, though, about how climate change hits the ground. Major episodes like wildfires, flooding, and storms are often getting chalked up to climate change, but who is being impacted? Major research suggests that women and children will be disproportionately impacted by climate change, and this has to do with things like the lack of economic security that women face and the types of work that women are doing. Today I'm joined by Damon and Anne from Community Forest International to unpack some of what I just mentioned. They also walk us through some of the programming that they're doing internationally and what they've learned. I learned a lot from this conversation, so I hope you do too. Anne and Damon, thank you so much for being here today and having a conversation with me. I'm really looking forward to both learning a little bit more about both of you and the organization you work with, and also digging in a little bit to kind of some of the logistics around what gender equality and climate change kind of looks like when it really hits the ground. In that lens, I'll actually just ask you to start off by telling us a little bit about Community Forest International.
Great. Thank you, Katie. Yeah, and I just want to say, like, off the top here also that Anne and I are both really happy that you're, you know, holding this conversation. I think it's a super important one. So we really appreciate bringing the gender lens into the climate crisis is super central to our work. And we're really excited, you know, that there are other people interested in talking about this. So Community Forest International is a group based here in Sackville, New Brunswick. And we work on climate resilience, both here in the Maritimes and also internationally, on some very highly impacted small islands in the Zanzibar archipelago, which is in the Indian Ocean off the east coast of Africa. And I guess at the ground level, our work in the two regions are, you know, it's quite different. But in both places, we really look for ways for people in rural communities, how they can make a living while working with their natural systems and building resilience in the process. And, you know, how communities can resist the growing impacts of a destabilized climate and also, you know, in some cases, reverse those damages.
So tell me a little bit about why you folks think the gender lens is so important to the climate discussion.
I think one thing, particularly in our work internationally, that comes up so frequently, we all talk about the increased vulnerabilities that women often face in the face of climate change, with sea level rise, the difficulty in finding food, water, caring for families. This work for mostly women and girls is made increasingly more difficult. And so those gendered impacts we see all of the time in the communities where we work in Pemba, and they impact more than just the women and the families themselves. They spread out into larger society and community resilience, not just individual resilience. But in the work that we do and in the activities that we undertake in Pemba, there's some other sort of less talked about factors that we've seen that have pushed us to work in a bit more targeted and concerted way for gender equality. So the activities that we work on in Pemba are for climate change resilient livelihoods, and they've succeeded in bringing a lot of women in who want to participate and to learn new skills. But some of the more deep-seated inequalities in these communities have limited their participation and their success and their independence in being able to undertake these activities themselves. So through this work, we've seen some of the really links between the structural inequality and the poverty faced by many women and women-headed households in Pemba and their increased vulnerability to climate change. So there's a lot of studies that we look at and we cite in our work and our proposals to show that communities that have better and more varied economic and income-generating skills are both more resilient to climate change and better to withstand sort of one-off disasters or sort of the ultimate impact, such as moving a community to higher ground or to better agricultural areas. So without women being able to participate fully in these kinds of income diversifying activities and learning these skills that will help them build resilience, whole communities become less resilient to climate change. So we see the links in building resilience that's accessible to everyone and not just sort of 50% or less of a community if the structural inequalities that women face where we work are holding back an entire region or an entire group of people to being able to succeed and survive as climate change is impacting some of these coastal and impoverished areas.
So just drawing off of kind of what Damon, you said in the introduction, and then Anne, what you just mentioned there, I was struck by kind of the reliance on communities for the kind of unpaid work that women are doing. So whether that's, you know, access to clean drinking water, caring for the household overall, and some of those things that are made perhaps even more difficult by the impacts of climate change, and then kind of flipping that to the paid work. I'd love to know kind of, I guess, your thoughts on what that linkage into more of a kind of formal paid economy, how that actually, again, does strengthen the community and the way that they're able to adapt when in so many of these communities we still see women and girls doing all of the unpaid work as well.
Like Anne highlighted, you know, something that is really clear to us is that any community or society where there are underlying inequalities, it's going to be more vulnerable to any type of external stress, including climate change. And when it comes to gender responsive approaches to climate resilience, I think a lot of attention is often paid to the unique vulnerabilities of women and girls, which are like really, really stark and really, really important to address. But the flip side to that is that the most effective pathways oftentimes to build resilience within a community is to work with women. And so, you know, what we've learned just by practice is that an approach to climate action that puts women's economic empowerment at the center is the one that gets the best outcomes. And, you know, your reference to all the different work that women do in their communities to support the people around them that is often not compensated. It's often also, you know, some of the work that's most high risk when it comes to climate change. So it's, you know, providing food or water or energy security to a household. And so they're doing these things which are critical to the health of their families and their households and their communities. They're not necessarily being compensated for them. And now those things are getting harder and harder and harder.
And some of those sort of family maintenance and household maintenance tasks in the communities where we've been working in Pemba, we've actually been able to translate some of those into potential income generating tasks while making them less risky and more accessible for women. So one of the things that I can think of immediately are kitchen gardens, which people are starting, you know, immediately outside their homes in environmentally sustainable and regenerative ways in a lot of times, which allows women to have access to healthy food immediately outside their homes, reduces the risk and need to travel to get food for their families. So we recognize that sort of care labor and home maintenance labor that women are doing in their homes. We're taking a step to make that task both more resilient in the face of climate change, make it easier for women to acquire the food that they need to continue doing this task, but also it's become an economic opportunity as well, and that some of these gardens we found are so productive that women are able to sell excess and turn this traditional non-paid labor that is outside of the economic sphere into an income generator for their families. And so we've been able to build some of those links that allow women to find opportunities to participate a bit more in public life that isn't always available for people that are constantly working just for maintenance of their home rather than for more economic participation within the community themselves. So there are some links there in connecting the typically unpaid and more economically generative labor.
Yeah, that's such a great and innovative approach to both being, both addressing challenges and concerns while also having, I think, a lens of, you know, cultural relativism as well and operating within the system that you are working within. I'd love for you folks to tell me a little bit more about some of the other projects that you've been working on and kind of specifically how you're seeing those impacts in the communities you're working with.
Sure. I mean, you mentioned, you know, being really careful when you're working outside of your culture to be in the backseat and really to be listening more than anything. And this is something that I think has been, I guess, pretty central to our success at Community Forest International, where we've always worked directly through partners who are from the communities that we're working in. And we've always really tried very hard to leave our biases aside when we're trying to build solutions together. But with gender equality, it's something that really brings it all to a head so often. Because when you talk about economic empowerment, especially in Zanzibar, where most people are relying on agriculture, you know, for a living, and yet men own the majority of the land for, you know, because of the legal constraints, because of the cultural norms, and, you know, just the wider systemic inequalities that exist, that really it causes a big challenge for us and for the communities we work with, because we're trying to empower women. Land is really at the base of their productive ability, and yet they are structurally cut off from access to land. They don't have equal access to land. They don't have equal access to opportunities. And that's where you do have to push for change and be more vocal and be more disruptive, you know, to societal norms to actually make real progress. And that's where our work gets very difficult, to be honest. Access to land is super important. And what we've done, in addition to the kitchen gardens, where people are really using unused land directly around their homes to primarily grow food for their family, but then also to sell surplus. And then that just creates more opportunities. Like, I've been floored how the people we work with on those kitchen garden programs, it will literally be the first time that a woman has ever made their own cash income. It's like the first time they've ever had their own money, oftentimes. And some of them are able to, you know, parlay that forward, develop a bit of a nest egg and savings, and then actually buy land. Some of our most successful partners have been able to buy land and expand into a small farm enterprise. But where that's not possible, we look for ways where women can, I guess, just join forces and work more collaboratively. So we've helped set up over 30 co-ops around various enterprise opportunities in Zanzibar, including agriculture, but also forestry and energy. And 9 of those are entirely owned and managed by women. So we've seen, you know, where there are, you know, great barriers, sometimes when people pool their resources and efforts, they can overcome those barriers. We do a lot of work with community land rights, and we've been trying as hard as we can to really entrench gender equality into the governing bylaws and policies and structures around the community lands, which then, again, sort of does a bit of an end run around the structural inequalities in access. I think it can't be understated also how little things, seemingly little things, like providing a household technology that burns less firewood to prepare a meal, like the clean cook stoves that we work with, that frees up time. It frees up resources. That's, you know, less hours that someone is putting in every week to collect fuel wood, which then, you know, allows them to spend their time on other generative things. And it's the same with water. When water security is improved, those are hours in someone's day that they can devote to advancing themselves in other ways. So it's something where, you know, most of the people we work with are farmers. So most of our interventions are land-based and are farm-based, but we also look for ways to basically help people unlock, I guess, the potential that they have by saving them time and helping them pool their resources.
When the women that we're working with are involved in these potentially income-generating activities, we have had to take a step back and look at some of the structural barriers that have been limiting their participation in formal markets. And with help from our partners at the EU, we did develop a gender-based enterprise curriculum to help women in this economic empowerment task to figure out what barriers they felt in turning some of these activities into income for themselves and their families. We did surveys. We worked with community members and consultants to figure out what women wanted and needed to earn their own income and to take part either alone or in cooperatives and trade groups to make money and to take their goods to market and to take their skills to market. And we've been incorporating that curriculum and that gender responsive enterprise tool across a lot of our programming. So for larger scale spice agriculture, for example, which was typically a very male profession, there were not a lot of women involved. Women have been participating in these gender-based curriculums, learning market skills, learning farming, and are now participating in not only the farming itself, but in the spice grower and the trade cooperatives that we're basing this activity around. So they're embedded in not only the governance, but also in the income earning structure of the project.
Yeah. And then in terms of some of the overall outcomes of all that work, over the last 4.5 years, we've trained over 6,000 women as leaders within their community, mainly around, you know, enterprises linked to forestry, agriculture, water, and energy, like I mentioned. And 59% of those women report that they control, 100% they control the income that they're making from those activities. And then another 39% have majority control, but in consultation with their husband. And only 2% report that they have no control over the income that they make. And so lots of room for improvement. But when we compare those numbers to the national averages in Tanzania, of the women who are paid for their work, 13% have absolutely no control over the income. Whereas the people we're working with, you know, only 2% are reporting that they really have no control. So it's working. Like we're seeing those results. We collect a tremendous amount of data in our work so that we can track. And we're seeing that it's an effective way not only to build community resilience and combat poverty, but also to improve gender equality.
Yeah, so much of what you've outlined really solidifies for me kind of two really foundational things. One, you really can't have gender equality without economic equality. And even further to that, without that kind of economic engine, climate adaptation and mitigation and responding to the climate crisis is just going to be that much harder for those folks that are not able to access forms of adaptation, really. So it's so critical.
Yeah,
absolutely. And we were talking about this morning, actually, how, you know, thinking about and acting on climate is actually, it's often a privilege for us, because so many people around the world are struggling with those day-to-day impacts and very immediate needs and under so much stress and under so many constraints that they just don't have necessarily the ability, the maneuverability to think about the longer term risks. And when it comes down to it, if you can improve someone's income, you're improving their resilience. Because no matter what happens in their life, whether it's a climate-related disaster or some other disruption, that income is just a really simple indicator for their ability to deal with that situation with some independence and you know, continue on. And that's what resilience really comes down to.
That really, what you just said about us having the ability or having the privilege to deal with climate change kind of struck something for me, and actually kind of the opposite. We have the privilege here in Canada, in a way, what we've really been hearing in you know, the election campaign, to not deal with climate change.
right? Like, we've got, like, that in itself is such a privileged stance. And I think we can relate a lot of what we've talked about today to the Canadian context, right? Like, folks that are experiencing economic insecurity will still be in Canada and are the ones that will be impacted most by climate change. Like, even just look at, you know, historic flooding, forest fires, like, folks having to literally get up and move their entire lives is something that is not a luxury, and incredibly difficult to folks who don't have, even if it's social capital, right? That don't necessarily have both the economic and social ability to do that. I remember chatting with somebody a while back about Vancouver and all the changes that were being made to Vancouver, with not only kind of, well, yeah, Vancouver really facing many, many climate issues, including earthquakes. But they mentioned the ability or the lack of ability for people to physically evacuate because the way that the city has been set up and how few people now actually have access to cars, which on the one hand we think is a great thing, which it is in one sense, but on the kind of evacuation side, it's really detrimental. So that I thought was such an interesting way of looking at kind of, yeah, like that, I don't know, privilege in a way that we've kind of talked about. But yeah, so I think it's interesting that even though the work you folks are doing maybe is kind of in a small place in the world, but it can really be, again, like all of those principles adapted back even here to our local context in Canada.
Yeah, I agree. And I've been reading, you know, so many articles coming out about different, so many climate related topics. And one that has sat with me is talking about sort of both zero waste movement and the local food and food movement, and how in both of these areas, so much of the responsibility falls on women in their homes, and this feeling of women being responsible, not just for their own family decision-making, but also for this much larger idea of, you know, eat local, zero waste, which are incredible things that we all need to do, but we're placing the burden of this on a group of people that are taking on so much additional responsibility already, and then also placing the burden of failure on the same group of people if they're not able to make the zero waste decisions, don't have the income or the time to eat locally, to prepare meals. You know, it very much is a gendered issue in so many ways that the prevailing conversation doesn't acknowledge or isn't able to sort of pull out the gendered strings of women's place in this conversation. And again, this is speaking from a place of extreme privilege, both in the West and in my own racial and social background. You know, there are issues that we're not able to cover talking about this in Canada as well, when it spreads so wide across the socioeconomic spectrum.
Oh, completely agree. Completely agree. And it's even when you just think about the ability to even access the conversations, right? Like you mentioned, depending, you know, the decisions, when we talk about kind of regulation and adaptation and things like that are made in many cases at, you know, local, provincial, and federal government levels. And those spaces are just also not accessible, not only in many cases to women, but to folks with many different backgrounds and lived experiences. And so if we're not engaging those folks in the actual decision making, then how on earth are we going to make decisions that are responsive to their needs?
Absolutely. And it's like, it's a complex thing. It's really hard to communicate that broadly, but it's so central to really effective change, right? And we've learned that, you know, the hard way. But for us, we're really centering women's economic empowerment in our work in Zanzibar in everything we do now, because it just works also. Like, it just gets the results that we all need. I heard Naomi Klein speak here a couple of years ago in Sackville, and she talked about, you know, a lot of the things that you both hit on in terms of how women's work is so undervalued. And at the same time, a lot of this work is so critical for the change that needs to happen in the world and the resilience of our communities. And it's also like that caregiving work, if we can call it that, is also some of the lowest carbon work in the world. So when we talk about transitioning to a low carbon economy, you know, these are the things that we need to be investing in more. And then at the same time, when I think about community resilience, we can talk about infrastructure or the economy, but really what it comes down to are the relationships and the culture and how people support each other. And so this is both the most valuable work. It's the work that is contributing to climate change often the least, and it's undervalued. So yeah, I guess I would just love to hear more about what, you know, the personal experiences of that, because, you know, I'm cut off from it, and I feel like I should know more about what that experience is like, because I think those are the experiences that are actually gonna guide us into a safe place in the future.
Yeah, well, I think here's to hoping we can get beyond, you know, the very basic economic discussion on climate change in our mainstream media, and we can start telling more of these stories and digging into the data and talking about what solutions are necessary for all members of our communities. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk. You can email me directly, katie@femwonk.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review. Thanks so much.